sense of diversity. I called attention yesterday to how different Isaiah was to Amos. And now we come to the document that is next to Isaiah in the scripture. But there are miles of difference, both between the times in which the men live. Jeremiah comes 100 years later than Isaiah. And even more so, a difference in the temperament and the approach and the lifestyle of these two individuals. I noted yesterday that Isaiah was one of those rare individuals who was well-born, an aristocrat from the very beginning, had all the security that goes with having great privilege, with great sophistication. And he was the kind of man who didn't seem to experience a lot of intrapersonal trauma. Very early in his life, he sensed that reality was one, that God was the ultimate, that he was good, that Isaiah himself had gifts, that what God was doing was a purposeful adventure. And so you remember how we talked about that he was able, in a very positive sense, that without seeming a great deal of struggle, to volunteer for God's service and to put his gifts into the process. Harry Emerson Fosdick says that some people across the river at the narrowest point, that is, they don't go through the agony that others go through. And Isaiah was that kind of person. There are a few well-born, seemingly well-put-together people who just from the very beginning are on with it. One of my modern church heroes is William Temple, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury in England during World War II. He was the son of an archbishop. From the very earliest times, he realized that he wanted to be a minister. When he was in prep school, he was writing back a test on Shelley and discovered for the first time when he was 15 that he had total recall. He reconstituted 235 lines of Shelley's poetry with that and had only read it once. And he realized then that all he had to do was just read something, and forever after, that was a part of his conscious process. He could even see the page. Everything he had ever read, he kept forever. Well, now, there are just not many people that well put together, and Isaiah was one of them. We're closer to my kind of fellow when we get to Jeremiah today, because here is somebody whose life was not characterized by security, by achievement from the very first, but of all the prophetic documents that we're going to deal with, there is probably more conflict, more inner struggle, more up and downness in Jeremiah than you'll find anywhere. This man really knew what it was to experience the heights of ecstasy. He also knew what it was to go into deep depression. On several occasions, he is suicidal. On other times, he is as angry at God as a man can be. At times, he can be very, very compassionate and tender toward people. At other times, he can be vindictive, harsh, critical. You have vast extremes here. A personality who really thrived running lots of conflict. And I find more identification with the way my pilgrimage has been in terms of Jeremiah's lifestyle than I do with Isaiah. If Isaiah was a kind of escalator type who just seemed to gradually move up, Jeremiah is a roller coaster who was up and down and in and out and high and low, and all of his life was characterized by agonizing ambiguity, great moments of insight, and great times of depression. Why was Jeremiah this kind of conflicted person? I'd like to suggest quickly three possible lines of insight. The first is that what we have here is a different kind of document than the other books of prophecy. The other books of prophecy were probably written down after these men had uttered what they did by folk who had admired them, and therefore they're pretty much external accounts of what the men did. You just see Amos and Hosea Isaiah pretty much from the outside. Hosea gives a little bit of what's going on inside to you. However, Jeremiah must have written down in a kind of journal form many of his own inner musings, and somehow these must have come to attention. The kind of thing that Dag Hammarskjöld did in his book Markings has a kinship to Jeremiah. We see more into the subjective states of this man than we do into the other, and though therefore maybe one of the reasons that he is more seemingly conflicted is that we simply know more about what was going on inside of him, and maybe Isaiah wasn't as well put together as he looks like from a distance. Brooks Hayes said that he asked an old lady in Arkansas once, did you ever see Halley's Comet? And she said, only from a distance. So we may be looking at these other prophets only from a distance. In Jeremiah, in the document, you really do get some internal insight. And so maybe one reason is that we simply have better reporting. A second reason, and I think this is perhaps closer to home, is that there was in Jeremiah, from the very beginning, a sense of inadequacy, a sense that he really didn't have what it took to do what was being asked for him, that stands in marked contrast to the kind of assurance and the kind of assertiveness that we saw yesterday when Isaiah said, here am I, send me. I'm sure of myself, I've got gifts, I trust your purpose, let's get on with it. Lay alongside that kind of self-image, this, which we have in the very first chapter of Jeremiah, if you want to look, it's in the first chapter, verses 4 through 6. Now the word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations. But then I said, ah, Lord God, behold, I do not know how to speak. I am only a youth. But the Lord said to me, do not say, I am only a youth, for to all to whom I will send you, you can go, and whatever I command you, you can speak. Do not be afraid, for I am with you to deliver you. What I see here is this stifling sense of inadequacy that always comes up to a challenge, always comes up to life saying, I can't. I don't have it. It's not in me to do it. I really don't have what it takes. That sense of drawing back into a kind of stifling, immobilizing sense of powerlessness. This, it seems like, is the self-image out of which Jeremiah had to do his life. And where did this come from? No way to say. I don't believe in the absolute Freudian principle that what happens to us in the first 6 weeks of our life lays down tracks that we can never get off of. I don't believe that, but I do know that the way we are treated in the early formative days of our life here as infants does do a great deal toward helping us form an image of ourselves. You see, here's an infant suddenly thrust out of the warm confines of his mother's womb, and though he's not in any kind of, he doesn't have critical powers, I don't mean to imply that, but there must be some instinctical curiosity when he's thrust out into this new world. Why am I here? Do I belong? Is this a good place? Will I be cared for? In other words, there are all of these questions about the mystery of the new confines. Now, if the big people begin to handle the infant with a sense of delight, if they communicate by touch, by the sound of the voice, by their attentiveness, that he really is there as something that they celebrate, that they are delighted to have his inclusion in their lives, then all of those images come through as saying, well, I must be okay. I must have some value. It must be good for me to be here. If, on the other hand, there is harshness and indifference, if one is neglected or if one is beaten and battered, then very quickly one must begin to say, well, I must not be good. It must not be good for me to be here. I must not have what it takes for this situation. And so a record gets put on inside our heads, and we start saying, I'm inadequate, I don't have worth, I have no right to be here, I can't measure up. And this kind of record plays and plays, and out of this self-image, we begin to script a lifestyle. And we don't know much about Jeremiah's home background, except he came from a priestly family in a little village north of Jerusalem. And later on in his ministry, some of his family did conspire against him. In fact, some of his kinfolk were actually in a plot where they were trying to assassinate Jeremiah. And it just could be that early in his life, he was treated in such a way that he began to think of himself as an inadequate and an insufficient person, so that every time a challenge was posed, he pulled back and said, I can't. This is not something that I have it in me to do. We really do need to be very sensitive in how we relate to particularly the tender little people that we come in contact with, because the way we relate to them can do so much in shaping or misshaping their self-image. Chaim Gano says that if you deal negatively with a little child and do it in terms of nature, if you say you're lazy, you're dumb, you're careless, you're sloppy, that kind of communication is a broadside to the little person's whole sense of himself. He begins to say, well, if I am sloppy, if I am careless, if I am dumb, there's nothing that can be done about that. I might as well give up. Gano says that we need to deal negatively strictly in terms of actions. We need to say, look, you are doing something sloppily, but you can do it better. You are doing something carelessly, but you can do it differently. When we deal in terms of acts, there is something I can do to change that. When we deal in terms of natures, it's a kind of broadside that decimates everything, and it leads us quickly to immobilize all effort. So, at least there is the possibility that Jeremiah responded to God's first word when God said, look, I made you, and I put you into history as a key that fits this kind of lock, and I'm going to be with you. All of this surrounding context of concern, and then Jeremiah says, I can't do it. I'm not old enough. I'm not eloquent enough. I don't have it in me. It's cringing back this I can't-ness, and it could be that this record of inadequacy was steeped into him way back in the beginning, and it appears to me that God had to struggle at this level with Jeremiah all through his life. It also appears to me that this is really where personal redemption is ultimately fought out. The most crucial area of interaction between you and God is at the point of your self-image, how you see and feel about yourself. And as we were talking yesterday, if we can let God define our personhood rather than defining our personhood out of our own sense of inadequacy, then there comes the liberation to get on with it, to become the person that we can be, to do the thing with God that he wants us to do. And I think the struggle that God has with every one of us is at the level of self-image. Almost all of us come out of our childhood with massive I'm not okay, inadequacy feelings, and it's at this point that God is challenging us, trying to change the way we see ourselves, the way we do ourselves, to change our vision of who we are, to take off this record of I can't and to empower us in I can-ness. I think this is what personal redemption is all about. The great thing that I see Jesus being able to do was to penetrate down to the bottom where men live with their self-images and turn around senses of powerlessness into senses of responsibility. Do you remember the time in Capernaum that he was teaching away in a real crowded house and suddenly there was a commotion over his head and began to see daylight, the tiles were coming off, and suddenly a man was lowered down on a cot right in front of him by four friends. The man was absolutely paralyzed. I take this to be the symbol of a man who had utterly internalized a sense of inadequacy. Now maybe he had never thought he could do anything, or maybe he had tried to do something and had failed and had become so humiliated that anyway he just buried down at the bottom, I can't do anything, and he finally began to express this in body language. He got to the place that he couldn't even lift his finger, totally immobilized. And this man was let down in front of Jesus, and he looked at him with a love and an intensity that went right to the root of the problem, and he said, my son, I forgive you for what you've done to yourself. I forgive you for the sin of thinking you were worthless when really you were made in the image of God. I forgive you for your failures when you tried to do something and it turned out badly. I forgive you for what you have done to yourself. Now, take your bed and walk. Take hold of your gifts and begin to take responsibility and stop being utterly passive and immobile. The miracle was that the word got to the place where there was sickness. The word got to the self-image, and the man who had been utterly immobilized got up, took his part of the load, and walked out the door. Now, this is what Jesus Christ wants to do for every one of us. This is what God was trying to do with Jeremiah. I think that only if we see redemption in a dynamic category. But the goal is not that we're passive. The goal is not that God perpetuate dependency and carry us around mechanically. But the goal is activating our canness and getting us on with our gifts and our responsibility. Now, some people are very threatened by that. They want a religion that carries little children, that reinforces this infantile passivity that never wants to be anything or do anything. My family and I have gotten quite interested in snow skiing, and a couple of winters ago we were over here at Vail. Heard this great story about a beginning skier who, by mistake, and he was frightened to death because it was so steep and with so many moguls. And so what happens to you when you get afraid is that everything goes. And so he lost his balance, began to fall head over heels, finally was able to catch hold of a tree, secure himself, and when the snow settled, his skis were off, just dangling off his boots. There he was, holding onto this tree, and it looked to him as if it was about 3,000 feet straight down. Well, in sheer panic, he cried, "Help! Help! Is anybody up there?" And his voice answered back, "I'm up here." He said, "Who are you?" "I'm the Lord." He said, "Well, Lord, send the ski patrol. Look at the shape I'm in. I'm a beginner. I'm over here on the advanced slope. Get me some help, quick." And the Lord said, "Have faith. Do what I tell you to do. Let go of the tree. Get your skis on. Ski on down the hill. I'll be with you." He said, "Lord, I can't. I'm a beginner, and this is an advanced slope. I never could get my skis on this steep an incline. I can't ski down that hill. Send me some help." And the Lord said, "No, have faith. Let go of the tree, put on your skis, ski on down the hill, and I'll be with you." There was a long silence, and then he said, "Is anybody else up there?" That is not just a joke. That is a profound insight into the infinite that is in us all and what we want of God. And I've been listening this week as sensitively as I can to a lot of things that are being said. And I'm really grateful that many, many students have found in God a sense of adequacy and a sense of guidance. But I'm a little bit uneasy sometimes when I hear somebody say, "I'm nothing. I must just absolutely become a limp leaf on a log," as if perpetuating dependency and passivity of just lying down and wanting Jesus to carry us around on his back was what it was all about. I don't think it is. I think the word is that you have a gift, and I know what's in you, I know what you can do, I will be with you to activate our canness, to get a sense of power into powerless people, call us to responsibility. I think that's what the gospel is about. And this was a struggle I had with Jeremiah all the time. One of the reasons that he may have been so conflictual is that he started with a script of inadequacy, and it took God a long time to take off one record and put on another. Another reason why his life was so conflictual is probably, though, simply the era of history in which he had to live. Of all the prophets, in which to have to do the work of a prophet. He lived in the last half of the 7th century, about 625 on down into 575. And he had to live in the time that all of the things that we've been hearing, Amos and Hosea and Isaiah predict, they were finally coming true. Israel had not done the things that she was supposed to have done. She had done things she shouldn't have done. She had left undone the things she was supposed to have done. As we have already seen, she had missed the primal vocation that God had for her to be a people of blessing, to perform before all history a demonstration of how you live justly and lovingly as a family. She had tried to play the power game, had tried to be like Assyria, like Egypt, and as a result of this, she was really sick unto death. And it was clear now that Israel as a political entity was not going to survive. And after 605, when the Assyrians defeated the Egyptians and were unquestioned lords of Western Asia, and when it was clear what those Oriental did, whenever they came in, they ravaged a country. They took the best people in exile so there would be no backbone for rebellion. They left everybody that was there in slavery. Jeremiah knew very clearly how Assyria operated, saw that there was no chance that little Judah could stand up against that kind of power. And so beginning in 605, Jeremiah simply said what was the truth, but what was bitter to hear, and that is that Israel is doomed as a nation. There is no way that we can survive politically. So the agenda is getting ready to be some taken into captivity, the rest living in slavery. He began to say, we are doomed as a nation. Well, now, obviously, that kind of word, though reality-based, was terribly, terribly threatening. And when he began to say it, he was accused of treason. He was accused of being unpatriotic. He was accused of giving aid and comfort to the enemy. In fact, just all kinds of hostility broke loose because this man saw deeply into what really was and what was about to happen, and he had the courage to tell it like it was to people who didn't want to hear it. Now, none of us like to hear this kind of threatening bad news, and our tendency is, instead of hearing the news, to turn and accuse the messenger. You know, I've known people who go to a doctor, and he has to give them a very difficult diagnosis about a dangerous disease that they have, and they just can't handle it, and so they accuse the doctor of not being competent, and they go until they find some quack who can tell them what they want to hear, and leave reality unrecognized. Back in the days when there weren't good communications, when a Greek city-state would send its armies out to fight, messengers would have to run back to tell how the battle was going. If they were winning, oftentimes they made heroes of the messenger. If they lost, many times they killed the messenger because somehow the idea is that the bearer of the word is responsible for the word. And the same thing is happening today. I know a world of people who say the only thing wrong with America is the press and TV. You know, they are telling us what's wrong with America instead of what's right, and they're the problem. You see, we can't face the deeper underlying difficulty, so we pin it on the messenger. Well, this happened to Jeremiah. He had an extremely difficult thing to do. He had to try to help the people get ready for what was going to happen. No way that Judah could survive politically. They were about to go back into the situation out of which God had rescued their forebears centuries before. And Jeremiah had to say, we've got to face into it. There is no escape. The judgment of God is coming upon us. A slave people who had been given the gift and opportunity of freedom had so missed their calling, had so refused to be family, just to each other, and had tried to be what they never were intended to be, that now what had been freedom was going to revert back into slavery. Now, I think you get an insight here into the basic struggle between God and all of that which is against him, between the forces of goodness and the forces of evil. God, as I understand him, is the one who is always trying to us and turn this into order and beauty. But there is another mysterious force at work in the universe that is always trying to turn beauty and revert this back to chaos. And this was what was happening in Israel's experience. They had been brought out of slavery when they were a no people and had been given an identity and a place in the world, but they had not been willing to receive that. They allowed the destructive, disintegrating tendencies to take over, and so order got converted back into chaos. And this seems to be the agony in which all of history finds itself moving. God trying to shape, create, the demonic trying to destroy, disintegrate. And man, I feel these same powers at work in my innermost being. There is a demonic. There is a death wish. There is something that is trying to do us in and take us apart and leave us in utter fragmentation. There is something mysterious, dark, satanic, that is trying to tear down what God is trying to build up. And if you don't know that, you're in real trouble. Or you're walking around on a battlefield not realizing that they're using live ammunition. And what I have to say to myself is that this death wish, this disintegrative, destructive tendency in me, I have to name it for what it is. I have to realize what it's trying to do to me, and I have to plead, cling to God to be my refuge and my strength against that within me, which mysteriously is trying to reduce me to chaos. Remember in the Gospels, they brought a little boy to Jesus who was demon-possessed, and Jesus began to ask what he did, and they said, well, the demon cast him into the fire. The other day, it cast him into the water. He almost drowned. I think you see there in very graphic picture images what the demonic would like to do to us. Whatever this thing is that hates God and can't stand creation and doesn't want anything that God wants, whatever this force is, what it really wants to do is to destroy us, and that's that. And if you know what's good for you, if you know what's good for you, you will side with that which is trying to build and shape, and you will fight with all of your strength against that which is trying to destroy you. If you don't know the enemy, you're in real trouble. Okay, there was disintegration at work in the life of Israel, in the life of Judah. Of course, the thing that Jeremiah saw coming did happen in 586. The final decimation of the temple of Jerusalem took place. No one has ever seen after that. That the temple was torn down. The best people were taken into captivity. The rest of the people were left in poverty and in slavery. And what he saw coming and what he tried to tell the people, you've got to get ready for, he wasn't now talking about let's save the nation. He was already talking about what do we do in light of the defeat that is sure to come. Now, the only way to really understand what he was doing would be to visualize Billy Graham getting on television some night in one of his national crusades and suddenly stopping and saying, listen, I've got to tell you the truth. America cannot stand. The Chinese and the Russians very soon are going to take us over. There's nothing that we can do. We might as well get ready because we're going to be conquered. Some of you are going to have to go into captivity. Others of you are going to be ground under the totalitarian state. Let's get ready for it. Now just visualize what the switchboards would be like if that kind of prophecy was put on us. Okay, this is what Jeremiah was having to say to Israel, and they hated him for it. They put him under house arrest. He was the Father Berrigan 10 times removed in terms of the hostility of the people thinking that he was unpatriotic. Assaults were made on his life. He just lived horribly, suffering, because he was having to see and say things as they were. So if you take these three together, we have a better document. The struggle with self-image that was always there, the I can't-ness versus God's you can-ness, and then just simply the era in which you live. There are some times that are harder to live in than others, and we just might as well accept that fact. And nations get sick and die just like individuals. He just happened to be there when the terminus time came and participated with a great sense of agony in the dissolution of the good dream back into chaos. He loved these people. There was none of this stringent outsider hostility. He really cared for these people. He went down with them. He got spirited off into Egypt to try to escape after the fall came. Jeremiah participated in the very things that he predicted. However, that's not all to Jeremiah, to just talk about him and why he was as he was. Alongside his open acknowledgement. And there are two great symbols of hope that he gave to his people before this awful crisis came, that even though it was going to happen, it wasn't going to be the end of God's purpose. it wasn't going to be the end of God's action. The first thing, the first sacrament of hope, was an experience that he had at a potter's house. This is in Jeremiah, the 18th chapter, if you would like to turn to that. I realize this is before the end had come. It was a kind of hope that he was setting around this trauma that was about to occur. He went down to the potter's house, and he watched him do his work. And back in those days, the potter had rigged up a wheel that he worked with his feet, still done in many places where they're folk craft. Took a piece of clay, whirled it around, began to shape it, form it. It had no shape. Then it came to have a very beautiful shape, but when the wheel stopped, there were obviously some imperfections in the clay. There were some things in it that had caused scars to be all around the pot. And when the potter saw what had happened, he said, "This is not what I had intended. This is not the kind of vessel that I can live with." Jeremiah watched to see what he would do. Would he take it, pitch it over on the junk heap, and get some more clay? No. He first of all crushed it back into shapelessness. The shape that it had had disintegrated. But then instead of throwing it away, the potter carefully began to pick out the imperfections, began to work with those things that had marred the vessel, and then put it back on the wheel and began to reshape it a second time. And this became for Isaiah a tremendous image of what God was doing with Israel. They had once been no people, shapeless. He had given them the gift of shape and identity by praying them out of slavery, giving them the covenant, giving them a sense that they had something to do in his economy. And yet the way that they had responded to his shaping hands was flawed. There were many things about them, their suspicion of God, their rebelliousness, their not wanting to be what they were gifted to be. All of this had made for a marred image, and God said, "This is not what I wanted. I can't settle for this." So Jeremiah saw the coming of the Assyrians, the being carried back into slavery, as the experience of being crushed back into shapelessness. But out of this experience was going to become a purifying, was going to become a removing of the suspicion, a taking away of that which had marred. And it was Jeremiah's hope that once again Israel would get back on the wheel. And of course we have seen this in history. The Jews have never been politically powerful. They have never, and of course right now they have some limited military strength, but it's the derived strength. It's not their own native gift. They have never been the kinds of people that were good at conquering and dominating with force. But they have always had a fantastic religious insight. They've always been sensitive to the awesomeness of God. And the ministry of Israel, the spiritual vocation, which moved on into the life of the church, you know, this has been a historical reality. God has put it back on the wheel. God has continued to try to get Israel and the new Israel, the church, to be what he meant for them to be. The other sacrament of hope that Jeremiah gave to the people was the vision of a new covenant, that God would someday finally bring to culmination that which he was trying to do from the start. This is, in my judgment, one of the most beautiful passages in all the Old Testament. It's in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 to 34. I'd like to read these and let you hear and sense the eschatological omega point toward which Jeremiah saw the great adventure moving. Jeremiah 31, 31. "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Not like the covenant which I made with their fathers when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, even though I was their husband, says the Lord. But this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will write my law within them. I will write it upon their hearts. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. No longer shall each man teach his neighbor and say to his brother, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. And I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." The vision here is that someday God is going to internalize His Spirit in the human spirit. Carl Imani has says that the great hope of ultimate redemption is that God will finally fix our waters. He will finally get down to the depths of our desire, of our drives, of that psychic emotional energy that is the power of life, and He will so captivate us, so internalize His Spirit in our spirit, so that we will love Him and love our neighbor, not because we have to, not because we're made to, but because we will want to. He will internalize His Spirit in our spirits. The covenant will no longer be something we have to struggle with as demand cuts across desire. But if we will let God's process of redemption come to its culmination, He will finally get hold of all of us. He will internalize the spirit of trust, the spirit of joy, the spirit of creativity. He will fix our wanters so that what we want and our joy are exactly identical. I heard Dr. Wayne Oates once illustrate this internalizing process with the familiar story of Pinocchio. Pinocchio was a wooden doll who became a person, but you remember that it was a gradual process. At first, Pinocchio had a mind, but he didn't have a conscience. He didn't know what was right and wrong. He didn't know where his own good lay. Jiminy Cricket was given the function of being Pinocchio's conscience. And yet the trouble was, Pinocchio would get away from Jiminy Cricket. And whenever he got away, he didn't know what to do, and he got in terrible trouble. And Jiminy Cricket used to say, if I could just get inside of him, if I could just be with him all the time, if we never were separated, then he wouldn't get into the kinds of scrapes that cause him trouble. Okay, the process of maturing with a child is internalizing those external realities that the parents know, and at first they have to exercise from outside. But the whole idea is that eventually what one's good is not something that you have to learn from out there, but it's something that has come to dwell in here. It is internalizing our own sense of what is best, which is God's will, so that we want to do it. The new covenant is that which finally will dominate the whole of personality. All of my many selves will at last get integrated around their true leader and in the fellowship of the one who knows how to bring us into joy. We will have the spirit within that will make us want to do that which is our best. In his spiritual autobiography, Report to Greco, Nikolai Katsantzakis pictured an earnest young man going to one of the islands off the coast of Greece where some old religious hermits were trying their best to get in perfect touch with God. This earnest young seeker went to one of the old fathers and he said, tell me, Father, do you still struggle with the devil? And the old man said, oh no, my son, I don't struggle with the devil any longer. I have grown too old, and he has grown old with me. He no longer has any strength. I wrestle now with God. And the young man with wide-eyed amazement said, with God, Father, do you hope to win? And he said, oh no, my son, I hope to lose. And that's what it means for the new covenant finally to be realized. The war will be over. The rebellion will have ended. We will finally have seen that he who began this thing for our joy really can be trusted. And when we finally have our suspicion uprooted, when we finally sense that in him is our peace, when we are healed from the bottom up and all of ourselves realize that he is the way, the truth, and the light, then comes the end. When we shall be filled with the glory of God like the waters cover the sea, when God shall become everything to everyone and creation will begin to know the joy that was always intended. 2,600 years ago, Jeremiah sensed that the goal of it all was the internalizing of the covenant until at last what we want and what he wants are the same.
Our struggle with God is over. Our rebellion is ended. We hope to lose everything that is against his joy, that in so losing, we may win.